Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. In Washington, I'm Ron Elving.
And from member station KUT in Austin, Texas, I'm Ken Rudin.
Ken, it's a pleasure to have you with us remotely. You can take that any way you like.
The way you prefer it.
You can take that any way you like. And obviously this week, although there are many other things to talk about, we're going to have to talk about these allegations regarding Herman Cain and the treatment of women at the Restaurant Association where he was the chief executive officer in the late 1990s. Ken, your thoughts?
Well, the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, seems to be doing to Herman Cain what common sense and what the other Republicans in the debates could not do, and that seems to put a dent in his image, which, as of now, in almost every poll, he is the leading Republican candidate.
This is fascinating. Just in the midst of all of these allegations this week, the Quinnipiac poll came out and showed him at 30% among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. 30%, nobody else was close to him, and, you know, really beginning to look like the dominant candidate. Romney was down in the low to mid-20s.
He had 23. Newt Gingrich had 10, and Rick Perry down at 8%.
Yeah, now Rick Perry fading away. Now
Rick Perry, my governor.
This is not the last word in polls, and there have been a lot of other polls, but Cain is suddenly doing well, even in places like Iowa and New Hampshire, where he has not spent very much time campaigning.
Well, that's the most interesting thing of all, because to talk about a national poll, there's no national primary, so to say how he's doing nationally doesn't make that much sense. But you're right, he and Mitt Romney are leading in the last Des Moines Register poll, and yet Herman Cain and Mitt Romney have shown up in Iowa fewer times than any other candidate.
Yes, so apparently people in Iowa and New Hampshire also have television sets, and they are getting their impression of these candidates largely the same way the rest of the people in the country are getting them, and not so much from these legendary kitchen meetings and seeing them down at the corner grocery store.
What this is doing to Herman Cain is what his opponents couldn't do in the debate. We talked about how 999 didn't make economic sense, and yet his numbers kept improving. He would be caught espousing basically a pro-choice position, even though Herman Cain is so opposed to abortion.
He was caught suggesting strongly that China didn't have nuclear weapons. Yet.
And then every time he does, you know, he does the thing, I have no idea, nor do I care who the head of Uzbekistan is. I mean, that's supposed to be cutesy. And yet, while we smarty pants folks in Washington roll our eyes, he just keeps going up in the numbers. But this is different. This is different. We said the same thing about Bill Clinton in 1992, saying these allegations against Bill Clinton are going to doom his candidacy. The Jennifer Flowers story came out.
And at the same time, the draft dodging story came out.
Right,
too.
The letter he wrote trying to get out of the draft. I mean, we said that there's no way he's going to survive this process. And yet, not only did he survive, I believe he was elected twice to the presidency. So,
although some of those problems never really left Bill Clinton, he did win two terms in the White House.
Right, and he left very popular. And even in his second term, when the whole Paula Jones case came and went, his numbers still, you know, improved. So we can make the case and say, well, this is the beginning of the end of the Herman Cain candidacy, and it may very well be, although nothing else has been the beginning of the end. But, you know, ultimately, it's up to the Republican voters, and at least I haven't seen any numbers yet, but they don't seem to be turned off yet.
As we said, the Quinnipiac poll came out on Wednesday of this week. It included polling done right up until Monday. But this story didn't really reach the full fury of the cable news emphasis and all the other attention that's been paid to it until Monday. So I don't really think that it's reflected yet in this poll. However, I think you make an excellent point, Ken. I mean, Bill Clinton reached some of his best numbers as president right in the worst days of the Monica Lewinsky scandal and just before he was impeached by the House. So clearly, people can have a counterintuitive reaction to these things and identify with the candidate who's being accused and say, well, they're just trying to do him in. And we might see some of that sort of populist backlash in this case.
And I think the Cain campaign, whatever there is to call the Cain campaign, because I still don't know if there's really a real operation there, but by focusing their ire on Rick Perry's forces and saying that it was Rick Perry who basically is behind this whole story that appeared in Politico last Sunday, that changes the dynamic of the story in a different way.
There is also an interesting characterization to be made here. I mean, as you say, his campaign leaves a certain amount to be desired. They don't seem to know what to do with a situation such as this. It seems to have been something of an accumulation, a collection of lesser lights in the campaign professionals world that went to work for Herman Cain. He has never really had the usual kind of conventional base as a candidate. So we're not really sure where the there is with the Herman Cain candidacy in the first place. And then for it to take a blow like this, he doesn't have as much to fall back on as, say, Bill Clinton had in 1991, 1992, when he first got into trouble. He had his years as a governor. He had a large campaign organization. He had a good angle on the rest of the Democratic field of 1992. There wasn't that large a field. So, you know, Bill Clinton was a very different kettle of fish back in that particular comparison than Herman Cain is today. And it seems as though this is the first big thing people are finding out about Herman Cain, bigger even than his 999 plan. They don't really know the content of. So it seems to me this is going to do more damage to him if you assume that he is just a parking place for people who are looking for someone to be the anti-Romney in this field.
I've seen many references by the Rush Limbaughs and the Ann Coulters of the world who are basically talking about race, that is, talking about the racial stereotype of an African-American candidate. We heard references to the high-tech lynching. That, of course, was a reference to the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court hearings in 1991. But it's interesting to me, all this time, when everybody was talking about, was race a part of the dynamic and the argument against Barack Obama, conservatives would say absolutely not. But when Herman Cain is attacked, they seem to say that race is a subliminal message here.
That's right. And vice versa, of course. It depends on whose ox is being gored. And one side will immediately say, well, this is just being done to him because of his race. And the other side will say, no, it has nothing to do with race and so forth. And they reverse roles.
Actually, that's true. Right. It's true about Cain and Obama. Exactly.
And of course, the Clarence Thomas comparison gets a little bit emphasized when Herman Cain goes out to enlist the support of his friends, Clarence Thomas and his wife, Ginny Thomas, who was interviewing him in a video that was shown on the Daily Caller website.
That is the D.C. culture. Guilty until proven innocent.
So, you know, the Thomas comparison is one that he's more than willing to bring in and reference in his own defense.
I mean, I don't know if we want to exercise the conversation about who may have leaked this. I mean, ultimately, the more important thing is whether he is guilty as charged or he did harass these women. That's more important than who leaked it. But obviously, Herman Cain has taken all the oxygen of the non- or the anti-Romney forces out of the Republican field. Once upon a time, as we said over and over again, we talked about Michelle Bachmann, we talked a long time about Rick Perry, and now, of course, it's Herman Cain, and he became the non-Romney. If Herman Cain is going to be supposed to be stopped, then obviously the person who's trying to stop him is somebody who obviously feels that he has a better shot against Mitt Romney. So you wonder about the Rick Perry connection. You know, Kurt Anderson, who's a Perry staffer now, was a consultant for Herman Cain's Senate run in Georgia in 2004, and the Cain campaign is saying that he's behind it.
And Kurt Anderson is saying he first learned of these allegations in Politico last Sunday.
Exactly, as the Perry camp is saying. But you just wonder that if Herman Cain does go away, and we don't see another debate until later this month, but if Herman Cain does seem to fade, who benefits from this?
Well, we don't know yet, and we don't know if this will prompt some sort of a shift in the anti-Romney, if you will, forces, or if they can find a candidate. Some people suggest John Huntsman will get another look before we're through, that he will seem to be a sort of new face, even though he's been out there in the debates for months, and that people could turn to him as one more person to give 15 minutes of fame in this search for the anti-Romney. But right now, it seems to me, you'd have to be feeling pretty good if you're Mitt Romney.
True, but the argument about John Huntsman, I mean, basically it's the conservatives who are looking for an alternative to Mitt Romney, and I don't see the conservatives turning at all to John Huntsman, who seems to be very happy appearing on Jon Stewart and, you know, the media's favorite list, but not conservatives' favorite list.
Let's go back to the last favorite of the conservatives that we had, Rick Perry. Has he been using the last couple of weeks to solidify his position as the anti-Romney, or is he raising more questions about his candidacy all the time?
Well, that's a very good question, because every time I keep thinking that he is the alternative, he gives a speech as he did the other day in New Hampshire.
This is such a cool state. I mean, come on, live free or die. I mean, you know, you gotta love that, right?
So all you have to do is go on YouTube. You could look at the unedited version and you could look at the edited version.
But I don't know which is worse.
Exactly. I don't know. He sounds incoherent. And you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, he's not a great debater, and that's why he didn't do many debates while he was in Texas. He avoided them for the most part. And I think everybody agrees that he was very unimpressive, to say the least, in the four or so debates he was in. But then when I see him give this set speech in New Hampshire, there were comparisons. There's always snide stuff on the internet, so you don't take that seriously. But just at face value, he looks so unprepared and
goofy.
So unprofessional.
He looks goofy. People have to watch this for themselves, and they have to reach their own judgment, their own conclusion. But he does not seem even as impressive as he did in the debates. In this 25-minute unedited speech, you can watch it as many times as you want. It is not going to make you think this is someone you want as your president. So he needs to get a little better control over the public image, the public presentation that he's giving, even under completely controlled, friendly, non-competitive, non-hostile circumstances.
And while 2 months, is either a long time away or not that long at all, he's still mired deep in the polls. And again, I don't give any credence to the national polls, but again, if the Des Moines Register has him tied for fifth place with Newt Gingrich with 7% of the vote, with 2 months to go before Iowa, I don't see how he comes back unless it's an enormous collapse by Herman Cain. It's just hard to see how he does it. And if that's the case, if Mitt Romney either wins Iowa or does better than expected, and of course, Mitt Romney snubbed the Ronald Reagan dinner in Iowa this week. He hasn't been in the state much at all. If he manages to do better than expected, and we love expectation games, Bill Clinton, of course, the comeback kid in New Hampshire, even though he lost it, everybody thinks he won it because he got such a great boost out of it. If he gets a good boost coming out of Iowa and then wins New Hampshire a week later, there could be a Romney steamrolling.
I don't see how they find an alternative to that scenario right at the moment, but everyone believes that they must. That there has to be an anti-Romney candidate. So if Herman Cain does not maintain his current lead after this controversy and all that follows, and if Rick Perry is not in a position to step up and take advantage, then where do those votes go? I agree with you, John Huntsman seems an extremely unlikely choice for conservatives. So where do they go? Will we get a Gingrich day? Will we get a Santorum boomlet?
Well, that's the question. Sometimes you need somebody new to excite. I think the excitement and the interesting thing about Herman Cain was that he was new, refreshing, and nobody knew who he was. Newt Gingrich, while a lot of people say he has been somewhat impressive in the debates, he's been around forever. He was speaker in the 1990s, which is, we're talking about 2 decades and more in the public eye. Ron Paul, of course, has his strong supporters out there, and he's polling third in the Iowa polls. And,
yeah, but he's got a 12% ceiling on his head, wherever he goes, he never seems to break through that. And maybe he will now. Maybe this will be the moment when he will. I can't see it, but I suppose we have to admit that possibility. Who else is in the field? Where else can this go?
But when you're talking about Ron Paul's ceiling, Mitt Romney seems to have the same ceiling. His numbers are 22 to 25% everywhere. I don't think it's moved since 2008.
Well, the difference there is that it's twice as high as Ron Paul's ceiling, and right. It could imaginably be enough to win in this field in a lot of these states. Is there still the possibility of somebody else getting in, even here we are past the filing deadline in New Hampshire?
No, absolutely not. That's why I think this is great news for Buddy Romer and Gary Johnson. No, I don't see anybody else who can possibly do it. It seems like it's Mitt Romney's to lose, and I think, Herman Cain, at least the last couple of days in the news cycle, it seems like more and more there may be a shrugging of the shoulders saying that Mitt Romney is the guy.
So this week we learned from the Secretary of State of New Hampshire, Mr. Bill Gardner, that they will have their primary on January 10th, 1 week to the day after the Iowa caucuses. This was pretty much predetermined, but it has taken some while to make it official. And so we now know what the dates are of the early events. In fact, pretty much what the dates are of all the primaries and caucuses. And we're ready to go. You and I have just decided that the Republicans seem to be stuck with Mitt Romney. We may be wrong, but there it is for the moment. The Democrats, on the other hand, are looking at slightly better numbers for their incumbent. Barack Obama, in the latest Quinnipiac poll, goes up from a 41% approval last month to a 47% approval, which, while it's still not 50%, looks an awful lot better than flirting with the 30s, as he has been doing in recent months. Do you think that's a real bump up, or do you think that that's just a statistical anomaly, I ask you, Ken Rudin?
Well, I do think it's a bump up because I think he's being more aggressive than ever before. I think the fact that he loves pointing to the fact that Congress's rating is at like 9%, and I suspect that part of the reasons Congress is at 9% is because Obama and his team are getting the message out that Congress is not doing the job. And, of course, we always refer to Harry Truman and the Do-Nothing Congress, the Do-Nothing Republican Congress of 1948, and that's how he ran for election.
Which was, of course, actually it was a very highly productive Congress, and what he was really running against were the things that they had done, like the Taft-Hartley Act.
Right.
But exactly. He called them Do-Nothing because they had gone home, and he called them back in a special session and made himself look good by contrast. So I think you've got exactly the mentality of what they're thinking in the White House right now.
And right now, you know, the words are not reaching across the aisle. It's not cooperation. It's not concessions coming from the Obama team. His new slogan is "We can't wait," and basically that's ostensibly about saying we can't wait for Congress to act. But given what he's doing, given the fact that he's traveling the country arguing on behalf of a jobs program that he know has no chance of getting passed, I think the "we can't wait" is we're going to define Congress, and he calls it the Republican Congress, even though it's a Democratic, a nominally Democratic-controlled Senate. We're going to define Congress and the Republicans before they get to define their own nominee. So while the Republicans still don't know who their nominee is it Kaine? Is it Romney? Is it Perry?
Is it John Boehner? Is it Mitch McConnell? Can the president succeed in making those Republican leaders of Congress look like the Republicans' leaders?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Bill Clinton in 1996 ran against the Dole Gingrich team. Not that Bob Dole was in close to beating Bill Clinton, but it was a Dole Gingrich ticket that Bill Clinton ran against, and maybe he'll run against the John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Mitt Romney team of 2012.
Yes, especially if there doesn't seem to be a real juggernaut kind of personality challenging him from the Republicans' actual nominee. If Mitt Romney seems kind of acceptable and unscary to independent voters or to the kind of people that Obama is worried about losing out of his coalition from 2008, maybe he can get people out to vote for him in the Democratic Party if he demonizes not his opponent, but the Congress.
But he's also demonizing Romney as well. And even though the Republicans don't know, I think it seems like the White House and the Democratic Party know who the Republican nominee will be before even the Republican voters do, because constantly there's a constant barrage of emails and stuff, you know, talking points out every day about Mitt Romney's flip-flops and he can't be trusted. I mean, David Axelrod and all those guys are on their weekly shows, the Sunday talk shows every week, talking about how Romney can't be trusted, how he goes from one position to another. And so they have the luxury, and I think Bill Clinton had this in 1996 as well, they have the luxury of knowing this is not going to be a challenge to his renomination, and all the millions and hundreds of millions of dollars that they're going to have at their disposal, why not spend some of it right now and attack the Republicans?
Try to define the guy that they're most afraid of, who's clearly Romney in this particular case. Now, a lot of other developments around the country this week being perhaps obscured by all the focus on Herman Cain and some of the focus on the Occupy Wall Street fallout, the Oakland violence, so forth. A lot of things that probably will matter in at least a structural sense in the not-too-distant future. I'm talking here particularly about Jan Brewer's decision in Arizona to interrupt the redistricting process by an independent commission that was established there by referendum more than a decade ago. The governor, Jan Brewer, decided to do away with the woman who had been running this particular commission because she has opposed some of the moves that the commission has made, specifically the choice of a mapping firm to come in and do the actual map drawing.
Right. The mapping firm has Democratic ties, and that was Jan Brewer and the Republican state Senate's argument for getting rid of the head of the independent commission. Look, the whole point for the voters to establish an independent redistricting commission was to take politics out of the redistricting process in Arizona. And here we have a clear look, obviously the Republicans are have the majority of the seats in the delegation, in the congressional delegation, but with this new lines, it looked like that some Republican incumbents would have to run against each other, and they would create a new, perhaps Latino-based, Democratic-friendly district. That was not what Republicans and state government wanted to hear. But to make an overtly political move, saying this person had gross misconduct in carrying out her duties.
That is, this person is Colleen Coyle Mathis.
Now, it's my understanding that the commission members have appealed to the state Supreme Court, trying to get Mathis back as chair. But again, this is one more reason why a lot of people feel that the political process should be separate from redistricting.
Yes, and of course, why, for the people who are actually in elective office, the power to draw their own districts is pretty close to an existential power. They are willing to go to extraordinary lengths, take terrible publicity, and seemingly defy the will of the voters in a referendum that created this commission, rather than accept the decision of a truly independent commission that's trying to draw maps that don't just take care of the incumbents.
A similar thing is happening in California. They also have a newly created independent commission. For years, the Republicans and Democrats winked on with each other. They had a little agreement that, you know, you don't hurt our guys, we won't hurt your guys. But now it looks like both Democrats and Republicans in California, many of them, are being thrown together in the same district. There's going to be a tremendous upheaval in the makeup of the 2013 California congressional delegation, and that hasn't happened in a long, long time.
That's right. In fact, California's had almost zero turnover in the sense of one district being won by the Democrats after having been Republican or being won by Republicans after having been Democratic for the last 10 years, and it was not much different for the previous couple of decades. They've gotten very good with the help of computers at drawing districts so that even with more than 50 districts, there's very little change election after election after election.
And, you know, we're talking a lot about 2012 and what's going on in 2012. We should still not forget what's happening in 2011. On Tuesday is Election Day. There are two governorships up at stake in Kentucky and Mississippi. We have a big issue in Ohio when it comes to collective bargaining for public employee unions. We have some state senates that may be at risk of turning. We also have the elections for mayor in some big cities like Baltimore and Houston, Philadelphia, Charlotte. All of them are likely to reelect the incumbent. In Houston, for example, Anise Parker, who became 2 years ago the first openly gay mayor of a major U.S. city. She's likely to win reelection. In Charlotte, North Carolina, which of course is a big city for the Democrats, that's where the convention will be in 2012. Anthony Fox, who's African American, also looks likely to overwhelm his Republican challenger, and that's good. He's working very closely with the Obama team. One mayoral race we should be looking at is in San Francisco. Edwin Lee, who became mayor after Gavin Newsom left last year to become lieutenant governor. Edwin Lee was appointed mayor. He's the first Asian American mayor of San Francisco, which is notable, but he's under fire from this. Accusations of voter fraud from groups that are associated with Lee. So that's a race to be watching.
Just to back up a little bit to those two governorships you mentioned, one of those is Steve Beshear in Kentucky. Do we expect him to be reelected? He's a Democrat.
He's a Democrat, and yet it's a state where President Obama is very unpopular, and yet Kentucky continually elects Democrats as governor. Only once since 1967 has the Republican Party won the governorship there, and he only lasted one term. That was Ernie Fletcher. But Steve Beshear has a clear lead over his Republican opponent, David Williams. Steve Beshear is very popular in the state.
All right, but in Mississippi, the Republican grip on the governorship is not likely to be broken this year, but it is a Democratic nominee of some note.
Right, that's Johnny Dupree. He's the mayor of Hattiesburg. He's the first African-American to win a major party nomination for governor of Mississippi. Now, for the longest time, Mississippi was like Kentucky, too. You knew that the governor would be a Democrat. But, you know, the last couple of cycles, especially with Haley Barbour on the scene, Mississippi has become a very loyally and predictably a Republican state. Lieutenant Governor is Phil Bryant. Haley Barbour, of course, is term limited. Bryant has much more money than Johnny Dupree. Bryant is a likely winner.
And just real quickly, Ken, what is your prediction for SB 5, the collective bargaining law in Ohio?
It goes down, and it goes down big, and this is good news for the Democratic Party and the unions, both of which were considered pretty ineffectual and almost obsolete after what happened in Ohio in 2010 when the Republicans and John Kasich won the governorship. They won a Senate seat. They picked up seats in the House.
So this gives some sense of there being life left in the labor coalition in the Democratic Party, and that's probably going to be something of a template for both the White House and for a lot of other Democratic candidates in 2012. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.